American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the Internet for Monday, September 12, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global Sit-Rep on Corporate Political Tyranny, Technology, and Trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for your free speech by speaking freely is Misanthropic Gods.
You can follow all these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to the smf.rantradio.com, and this would be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Grid Archers 155-74666. What we need most of all right now is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today is Anthony Metaluna, Morp Sky Tower, Flash DUI Adder, Dark One Sunkiller, Legion Rosenman, Anastasia Jennings, and that looks like everybody. Today I might be a little slow to respond if you couldn't tell by my intro here. I have had a really long day. I slept an hour and a half since yesterday afternoon. I just got off a shift riding the ambulance, and I worked last night, so I'm a little bit out of it, and I'm drinking a Monster, so I'm trying not to fall asleep during the show, but please forgive me if I'm a little out of it. But another thing that I was just going to interject here a little bit is I'm just going to mention a little bit about 9/11. You know, didn't really want to cover it that much because there's already so much media play, but I figured I would interject just on the sole principle that it's been 10 years, and that really is a big deal. It really has defined the decade as well as my generation. You know, we grew up with that stuff. And, you know, it's still going on now. I would also like to mention just how important it is for us to make our own judgments about what happened instead of listening to each side, you know, one way or the other, you know, the crazy, you know, conspiracy theorists who go way, way out there, you know, and then the news media that's telling us one thing and the government that's telling us one thing. You know, I expect everybody to, you know, I kind of push them to go out and look at the raw data yourselves, you know, do stuff like I've done. I've looked through all of the 9/11 pager logs that were released. I looked through every single one. I scrolled through the whole thing. It took me a couple of nights, but it was very interesting. And I'm planning on listening to some of the recently released audio tapes of dispatch as well as military communications on 9/11. So, you know, and another thing that I've done is I've actually talked to a survivor of the attack on the Pentagon and who was permanently injured in the attack. And I talked to that person, and I was able to get their opinion on things. You know, and a first-person perspective really is a big deal. And, you know, what I believe matters not, but I do push everybody to do a little bit of their own research. Plus, you know, it's fun to learn, and it's fun to learn about history, and especially an event that's so widely covered. You know, it's that you can get so many different angles and so much raw material to work from. It's really good.
Yeah, the thing about 9/11 is it strikes me as a tragedy that never really stopped happening. I mean, look at all the stuff that's happened in the last 10 years that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for 9/11. So that event is still being felt today. And I mean, this news program is pretty much a good indication of it. I mean, half our news is nothing but the shit that's going on in the world today, almost as a direct, or if not direct, a pretty close result of 9/11. And speaking of which, let's move right along into the news. Our first bit of news here is InfoSec Alert. Certification Authority DigiNotar compromised, thanks to the doctor. Now, everyone's pretty much heard about this if you're in the computer security community, but the doctor was the first one to send it to me, and the link for the article also has a quick how-to in protecting yourself, so if you didn't already know about this, check that out. SSL certificates are used to validate the identity of a website to users. Over the weekend, it was found that DigiNotar, a Dutch certificate authority, has issued a rogue SSL certificate for Google.com. Today, this was confirmed by DigiNotar in a press release. According to DigiNotar's own investigations, they found that they were compromised on July 19th, 2011, and several rogue SSL certificates had been issued, according to, including the one to Google.com. All the other ones were revoked, but for some reason, DigiNorm is revoking the one issued to Google's domain. Why is this important? With the rogue certificate issued by a trusted CA, it is possible to do man-in-the-middle attacks and listen to any traffic going to Google services such as Google Mail, Google Docs, Google Plus, and Google Apps without any visible warnings to users. So what this is a man-in-the-middle attack is when you think you're going to a website or connecting to another server or whatever the case may be, but you're really connecting to someone who's put themselves in the middle between you and the server, and they may even actually route your traffic on. You may actually get connected to where you're trying to go, but they're collecting that information or doing something along the way that's usually malicious. So that's what these certificates are supposed to protect you against, and this one's been compromised. So if you haven't already fixed it, check the link and get that all fixed up.
Yeah, you know, it really is, again, you know, just like I say almost every damn show, you know, I mean, you got to be careful out there, and you got to realize that, you know, stuff's getting compromised, and it's a hairy world out there, and like you said, a lot of it's in direct correlation to 9/11, you know, and this isn't, you know, in particular, but you know, in these days and times, you gotta watch out, and you know, you gotta cover your own ass, so be careful out there, boys.
Yeah, This can happen to anyone. We've got more news here on the same thing in more DigiNotar news, thanks to Psychros. DigiNotar hackers targeted CIA, Mossad, and MI6. And this really isn't so much about them, and this is more about the Dutch government. The Dutch government has revoked trust in DigiNotar and released a list of over 500 fraudulent certificates issued by the hackers who broke into the company's infrastructure last month. Some of them are for the domains of the CIA, Mossad, and British Secret Intelligence Service, SIS. The DigiNotar breach was discovered a week ago when a rogue Google.com certificate, blah, 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 that was the last story. The browser vendors reacted promptly by removing the DigiNotar CA root certificate in their products, but kept the one for DigiNotar's PK iOverhide, I think I've got that spelled wrong here, sub-CA, which is used to sign Dutch government certificates. The investigation into the incident was ongoing, but the security lapses identified are so serious that the Dutch Minister of Internal Affairs has urged an instant press conference at 1:15 a.m. that the sub-CA should no longer be trusted either. So not only is like the Google one and a few other ones are compromised, but actually for the whole of the Dutch government, what they're using there, theirs is all compromised too. So this goes a lot farther reaching than a few websites that are compromised. This is, like, we've got an entire government here, we've got a few intelligence agencies, so any connections through the internet to them are potentially compromised right now if you haven't taken steps against this DigiNotar problem.
You know, and again, like you said, this shows that this really can be done to anyone. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, these government agencies, you know, Mossad, you know, SIS, CIA, you know, so on and so forth, they actually have fairly lax security. And, you know, again, you know, just cover your asses, boys. That's I keep repeating it and I keep saying it, but, you know, I can't say it enough, though. That's the problem.
Yeah, they have fairly lax security on their websites because, like, you always see that, like someone, I don't know, a non-op or whatever is going, yeah, we took down the CIA's website or whoever. It's like, well, it's no big deal. It's not actually their systems. It's just their website. But the more important point is that people trying to interact with those agencies are probably going to be doing it through their website these days. So it's not so much about the agencies themselves being targeted. It's whoever's trying to contact them, which can be a serious problem if, like, law enforcement or whatever is trying to contact the FBI and their information is getting intercepted.
Or maybe not even, you know, law enforcement, stuff like job applications, you know, where there's a lot of sensitive information out there. You know, you're putting your social security number, you're putting your work history, you're putting everything on there. You know, if you're interacting with them through their, you know, main website, then that also could be an issue.
Oh yeah, for sure. This has got really big reaching implications and will probably actually change the face of authentication in the next few years here. Moving right along, in Shadowrun news, thanks to Wyandi for this. Apple employees may have falsely represented police officers. This week, CNET reported a story about how Apple is working with the San Francisco Police Department to retrieve its lost iPhone 5 prototype, which is something I thought was fucked anyway. The police and Apple apparently traced the phone to someone's house and showed up on his doorstep, threatening him and his family. The only problem, the SFPD has no record of any house search or any case in general, raising the question whether Apple employees falsely impersonated the SFPD, which happens to be a serious crime in California and in most of the civilized world. After CNET's news story broke, the SF Weekly contacted Sergio Calderon to talk over the phone what the heck happened that day. He details how six officials, four men and two women, claiming to be of the San Francisco Police Department, showed up on his doorstep, claiming they traced the GPS signal of the lost iPhone 5 prototype to his house. The six officials asked Calderon if he had been at a bar where the prototype was lost, and indeed Calderon had been there. The officials then asked if anyone in Calderon's house was staying in the U.S. legally, or asked if everyone in Calderon's house was staying in the U.S. legally, and that the family could get in trouble. Even though Calderon and his whole family are legal citizens of the United States, he got nervous and allowed the six officials to search his house, car, and his computer. They found nothing. Then they offered Calderon $300 if he returned the phone. They made it seem like they were on the phone with the owner of the phone, and they said, "This person's not pressing charges, they just want it back, and they'll give it to you for $300, he told SF Weekly. As officials left, one of them, Tony, gave him a phone number he could call if he had further information about the phone. SF Weekly decided to call his number, and it was answered by Anthony Colon, who confirmed he was an Apple employee. I lost my place here. Yeah, his LinkedIn site, which has been taken down, SF Weekly has screenshots of the profile, confirms Colin was a senior investigator at Apple. He was a former San Jose police sergeant. Former, which means he's not currently an active police sergeant. The problem with all this is that the San Francisco Police Department has nothing on record about the search, or even about any case in... I think I copied this from somewhere else. Both of these are serious crimes, said SFPD spokesman Lieutenant Troy Dangerfield. There's something that's going on that needs to be investigated now. If this guy is saying that people said they were SFPD, that's a big deal, he said. There's something amiss here. If we search someone's house, there would be a police report.
Hey, where this guy went wrong is he let them search his house without a warrant. Regardless if they were police or not, you do not let the police search your house without a warrant. I mean, that's part of why it's in the Bill of Rights. You know, it's in the Constitution that you have the right, you know, to not have a legal search and seizure. And that's exactly what it is this was, you know, regardless if they were real police or not, they were illegally searching his home. And, you know, he let them do it. He granted them permission, so it wasn't quote unquote illegal. But, you know, the fact that they didn't have a search warrant, he could have absolutely said, no, you can't come into my house. And he could just shut the door in their face and that'd be that. And so, you know, just as a tip here, if the police don't have a search warrant, don't let them search your shit. You know, that's kind of why they need search warrants. You know, regardless if you've done anything right, wrong, or morally gray, it doesn't matter. Don't let them search your shit until they go through the due process of law. That's why it's there. It's there to protect you and to keep them from doing, you know, bullshit to you and incriminating yourself. Or them, you know, finding evidence of something else that was completely unrelated. But another thing is, you know, if Apple really is using, you know, this former, you know, San Jose police sergeant, and him and his team are impersonating police officers, oh man, that is just going to bring a whole world of hurt to Apple, you know? If it's found out that this actually happened, you know, and these guys were actually impersonating police officers and Apple knew about it, oh man, you think that whole, you know, UK newspaper scandal where they were hacking the phones and stuff was a big deal. You know, this'll be just as big, you know, if they were impersonating police officers to try and find their goddamn phone. And another thing is, you know, if you did have this stupid phone, why wouldn't you, you know, turn it off, take out the battery, and put it in an RF shielded bag? You know, even if you did have it, why in the world would you leave it on, mess with it, so on and so forth? That's just, you know, asking for trouble, especially because, you know, Apple... and another thing, why the hell did Apple lose a second device in a bar? You know, this... I'm questioning if this was, you know, even deliberate. Because, you know, once is a fluke, once is a mistake. Twice in, what, a year? It's been a freaking year? since it happened? What the hell, Apple? Get your shit together.
One thing that strikes me with the story is I'm assuming that these people weren't in uniforms. If they were in uniforms, then the shit's gonna hit the fan here. But I'm assuming they weren't in uniforms. If anyone ever comes to your house, even if they have paperwork, and they're not in uniform, call the police. I've never heard of a situation where cops will show up to your house and all of them will be plainclothes if they're going to be searching your house. Typically, there will at least be uniformed officers with them. So, if you ever bump into someone who claims to be a police officer and they're uniformed, by all means, call the police. They'll either confirm his story or send cops to arrest the guy. Moving right along, in pharma fascist news. Thanks to Psychros for this one. Indian government groups face off with drug maker Novartis in court over patenting cancer drug. In a case that could affect India's role as a drug provider to the developing world, the Supreme Court has begun hearing arguments Tuesday on whether or not the government has the right to deny a patent to Swiss drug maker Novartis AG for its life-saving cancer treatment Gleevec. A victory for the company, AID groups warned, could open the door to patenting dozens of other generic medicines made by India's $20 billion drug industry and sold to needy nations at far lower costs than those charged by Western drug manufacturers. There will be nothing left to defend if we lose, said Lena Magani of Medicine Sans Frontières, or MSF, that's Doctors Without Borders. The generic industry is just going to have to pack up and leave. The case, launched soon after India passed its Patent Act in 2005, revolves around a legal provision aimed at preventing companies from seeking patents or extensions based on minor changes to existing treatments, a practice known as evergreening that is common in Europe and the United States. The provision has allowed India to reject patents for a range of older drugs for cancer, AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and other illnesses that are made by India's generics industry. It has also led to the rejection of a Novartis application for Gleevec, which argued a newer, more easily absorbed version qualified for patent because it was demonstrably more effective. The blockbuster drug keeps chronic myeloid, leukemia, and some other cancers in remission. Its earlier version was ineligible for an Indian patent because the country gives no protection to drugs invented before 1995. Novartis insisted the revamped Gleevec, marketed outside the United States as Gleevec, spelled with an I instead of an E, weird, represents a unique breakthrough rather than just a tweak on the old formula. And the new Indian law intended to as a hurdle for evergreening is not applicable at all, said the company in a statement. But Indian patent officers and an appellate court said that the change only amounted to an obvious development on an existing treatment and is not knowing when the Supreme Court might rule.
No, I'm a little bit... I don't know how I feel about, you know, copyright laws for, you know, drugs, especially drugs that, you know, can cure these horrible diseases, you know. I mean, on one hand, you know, yeah, they develop these drugs, and it's their product, and that's how they make money, but again, you know, these are life-saving drugs, and they really do make an enormous impact on people's lives, and, you know, as a medical professional, you know, I really don't know how I feel about it, you know? I understand that it's the company's, you know, work and everything, but I really don't know how I feel about drugs like this, you know, especially, you know, anti-cancer drugs, especially, you know, drugs that affect, you know, permanent, you know, death-causing illnesses that are, you know, horrible, like cancer and leukemia and all this stuff. I mean... That's some BS to you know, not let that get to people, or not let that get to people because it's so damn expensive.
I'm of the opinion that they should let them patent these modifications of drugs, but a simple solution to the problem they're having now is that it looks like what's happening is when they change the drug a little bit and then repatented it, it still protects the old drug, so it can't be a generic can't be made. I think that those differences should be considered enough that the old drug is still going to be opened for generic manufacturers, and a new drug, it could be more effective, so they get to repatent it, and that way it allows the companies to stay at the leading edge of their industry and have their own drugs that no one can compete with, kind of thing. But the older versions are out there so that people can get a hold of them if they can't afford the new ones, which should also force the prices down for the new ones, because they want to stay competitive with the older drugs. And that would be a simple enough solution here. I think here...
Yeah, well, the way that the patent law, at least here in the United States, works, I don't know jack all about Indian patent law, but the way that it works here, I think it's 10 years that they're able to patent drugs, and then after 10 years, they're able to become generics. But I think with this, I think it's kind of BS that they just, you know, revamped the formula pretty much specifically to make it so you couldn't get generics on the market. I think that it should be, you know, for each specific drug, even if they revamp the formula, I think that it should be for each specific drug that the copyright's good for. So even if they revamped it, the copyright on the old one still lapsed, so now they can make generics. That's what I think about this specific situation.
Yeah, I think that would actually solve the problem totally, because that way they get to be ahead of their industry, but at the same time they wouldn't be able to dominate the market like they do now. So I really hope that the medical industry wins these court cases here, so that they can get these generic drugs and really start helping people in these lesser third world countries. So moving right along in nanotech news, this is thanks to Wyandi for this one. Electric motor made from a single molecule. Researchers have created the smallest electric motor ever devised. And keep in mind, a molecule can be quite variable in size, but it, you know, I mean, it's still pretty damn small. A motor made from a single molecule is just a billionth of a meter across, is reported in Nature Nanotechnology. A minuscule motor could have applications in both nanotechnology and in medicine, where tiny amounts of energy can be put to efficient use. Tiny rotors based on single molecules have been shown before, but this is the first that can be individually driven by an electric current. People have found that before that they can make motors driven by light or chemical reactions, but the issue there is that you're driving billions in at a time, every single motor in your breaker, said Charles Sykes, a chemist at Tufts University in Massachusetts, U.S. The exciting thing about the chemical one is that we can excite it and watch the motion of just one and see how it's behaving in real time, he told BBC News. The butyl methyl sulfide molecule was placed on a clean copper surface where its single sulfur atom acts as a pivot. The tip of the scanning tunneling microscope, a tiny pyramid with a point with just an atom or two across, was used to funnel electrical charge across into the motor, as well as take images of the motor as it spun. It spins in both directions at a rate as high as 120 revolutions per second. But averaged over time, there is a net rotation in one direction. I don't really know what that means. By modifying the molecule slightly, it could be used to generate microwave radiation or couple into what are known as nano-electromechanical systems, Dr. Sykes said. The next thing to do is get the thing to do work that we can measure to a couple other molecules, line them up next to one another, so they're like a miniature cogwheels, and then watch the rotation propagation down the chain, he said. As well as forming a part of the tiniest machines that the world has ever seen, such minute mechanics could be useful in medicine. For example, a controlled delivery of drugs to targeted locations. But for the moment, Dr. Sykes and his team are in contact with the Guinness Book of World Records to have their motors certified as the smallest ever.
Screw medical applications. I want some freaking, you know, I want some bio implants here. You know, I want some, you know, muscular augmentations and all that fun stuff. You know, screw that. Medical, yeah, that'll be second. I want augmentations first.
I want little nanites that run around my blood and repair injuries as I get them. That's what I want, and this seems to be a good step in that direction, because it helps if they have motors to run around on. Moving right along, in sharing equals terrorism news, thanks to the doctor for this. Student who ran file-sharing site TV Shack could face extradition to the U.S. The mother of a British student who is facing extradition to the United States over alleged copyright offenses has spoken of her anguish to over a possible jail sentence. In a case carrying echoes that of Gary McKinnon, the computer hacker that has spent years fighting U.S. extradition, the 23-year-old undergraduate Richard O'Dwyer was arrested late last month at the request of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department. Until last year, when police and U.S. officials had first visited him in his student accommodation in Sheffield, O'Dwyer ran a website called TV Shack, which provided links to other sites where users could download pirated versions of films and television shows. He appeared before magistrates in the capital this week for a preliminary hearing on the planned extradition, which he is fighting. In the case seemed beyond belief, said O'Dwyer's mother, Julia, from Chesterfield. The first he knew about it was this visit from the police and the American officials in November. She said, he shut down the website the very next day, and I didn't think he expected to go this far. But even in May, he had spent the night in Wandsworth Prison, as the court was too slow for us to sort out his passport and bail. Richard's still studying in Sheffield. He's still doing his best not to think about it. But it's a real strain on the family. I wake up every morning and think about it. What can we do? I'm no expert, but I've read the extradition treaty from cover to cover. It is the UK's 2003 extradition agreement with US campaigners say, which is at the center of the problem. Much criticized in the case of McKinnon, it currently contains no provisions for what is legally known as forum, which would allow a UK judge to consider whether a case is being heard in the UK or abroad.
Wrong, this is wrong, this is all kinds of wrong, all over the place, everything about it's wrong. I don't think that, you know, linking to material hosted at another site should be illegal, period. It shouldn't be a violation of copyright laws, that's bullshit, you know? All you're doing is just linking to something, and I really don't like that. Another fact is that, you know, they're trying to extradite this guy to the U.S., and they had, you know, visits from American officials. I think that this is wrong. I don't want my country, you know, I don't think that this kid did anything illegal in the first place. B, I don't want my country, I don't want my tax dollars paying for this kid to get extradited from the UK to the US. I think that is wrong, 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 wrong. Oh my God, this is like giving me an aneurysm right now. It's just, everything is wrong with this story. I can't support this at all, in the slightest.
Yeah, I didn't include it here because the article is quite long, but the server wasn't in the U.S. The server was in the U.K. The website was a U.K. address. That they're like, everything about this crime, if there is a crime at all, which I don't think it is, happened in the U.K. None of it happened in the U.S. He wasn't hosting any of the files. He was just hosting links. So everything was in the U.K. So basically, let's assume there that he committed the crime. So he committed the UK crime. He's a UK citizen in the UK who committed the UK crime. Why is he being extradited to the US? What the hell?
Yeah,
because
I can't
because
figure
the
that
internet?
Out. I guess I don't know. When the hell did the US become the internet police? You know, if they're violating fucking copyrights, then fine, let them. If they're in other countries, what the hell can you do about it? You know, but all because the freaking UK is so buddy buddy with the US, and they just said, okay, yeah, we'll hand over our citizens. This is wrong. The UK should be pissed off about this. They should not be saying we should allow them to send our citizens to another country for something as bullshit as this, especially. You know, if he had done something over here in the US, you know, not something like this, but if he had actually, you know, done something like a violent crime or something like that in the U.S., I really don't have a problem with him being extradited to the U.S. to, you know, to stand trial. But, you know, from the news that I'm seeing here, he didn't do anything to violate U.S. law, and he shouldn't be sent over to the United States, and people in the U.K. should be flipping the fuck out.
I'm just looking at this. This sets a pretty scary precedent if he is extradited and sent to the U.S. and convicted of his crime. And that means you're not safe anywhere in the world for anything you do. I mean, sitting here right now, I'm sure that making this news show is illegal somewhere in the world. And because it's on the internet, someone in the world can get pissed off and declare us criminals and get us extradited to their country. And then after we get out of prison there, someone else could declare the exact same thing, and you could go from country to country, from prison to prison, over something that's not even a crime in your own country. Now, that's a pretty extreme end of what's happening here, but it's something that can happen if they allow this extradition to go forward. Because they're basically saying that any crime you commit anywhere in the world now, if it has to do with the internet, is now a crime anywhere that they have a law against it, even if the crime wasn't committed in their country.
Since when the hell did the United States government become the world police, B, the freaking copyright police? I really want to know what the hell jurisdiction they have over this case, you know? And unfortunately, this is all, you know, third-hand news coming from this site. You know, I'd really like to see the documentation that they have. but, you know, none of that was included, so we can't really check that out. But from what I'm seeing here, he did nothing to violate U.S. law at all, period. And I don't understand why the U.S. government's even interested.
Well, this is just showing that corporate interests are now taking precedence over even borders now, which is scary. That means corporations, because, I mean, the U.S. wouldn't be going after this kid if it wasn't for the fact that the music and TV industries are going after pirates so hard. So basically they're saying that corporations now have more rights than countries, not just the citizens anymore, entire countries, because the UK is just handing over their citizens right over their border for something that's not even really a crime, and if it is a crime, it's not a serious one. Moving right along, in more craziness news, in corporatical censorship news, thanks to the doctor. Blue Coat's role in Syrian censorship and nationwide monitoring system. This article has an obvious political slant, and it was very difficult to trim down without losing much of the important info. I did have to cut a lot out, so you might want to wade through the article yourself. We have already talked about Blue Coat, a company from a country that allegedly sets other countries free by bombing their populations under the pretense that these countries own imaginary, of course, weapons of mass destruction. Yes, we are talking about the USA. So yeah, you can see the political slant already. Just like France, Mickey Mouse's native country is really up to date on internet filtering technologies. But as those technologies are prohibited in almost every democratic country in France, Code de Posts at Communications is very strict on the matter. And companies have to find a way to sell these censorship tools, it's not uncommon to sell a couple to renowned dictators, like this French CEO, who on the 13th of February 2011 was in Tripoli and sold a nationwide monitoring device to Gaddafi, as well as an NAS large enough to entirely cache Google. This story was published in Reflet.info and made the headlines of WSJ last Monday. Today, thanks to our friends from Telecomics and the support of other hacktivists, more or less affiliated with Anonymous, we are able to release new elements in Blue Coat's implementation in setting up in Syrian censorship and repression. We've studied how Syrian censorship works more closely. We suspect that they use two different technologies. The first one is rather simple and reasonably efficient, but can be easily bypassed, a filtering proxy. Our friends from Blue Coat, who we honor today, have a large number of tools dedicated to internet censorship. They are always presented as benevolent tools which will supposedly protect our kids from pedo-Nazis on the web, or protect your Windows OS from viruses. Incidentally, in some dictatorships, DPI can also be used to eradicate any kind of opposition or to control the information flow at a very large scale. Of course, this purpose is not described in marketing brochures, although it can be found in some confidential white papers, just like the one released by Osmos, I think, which details the benefits of nationwide DPI. In some tests that were directly performed from Syria, which allowed us to highlight the use of filtering proxies, as well as possible use of deep packet inspection tools by the Syrian government, by means of American technologies created by Blue Coat, represent here the tests that they have carried out. We will try to give you the main results by describing the procedure which we have followed and detailing what we observed. So they have a lot of data here about all the tests they've done from both outside and inside Syria. And as you can tell, I cut a lot out of the article because they really, really went heavy on the political stuff there. So you should definitely wade through that yourself.
You know, I think that pretty much any type of censorship, regardless of what it is you know, pretty bad stuff. You know, I think that's pretty evil. You know, that's going into the evil category. You know, I mean, this content is rated EC9 or EC10. You know, it's getting very, very equilibrium around here. And I'm really sad that, you know, American companies are standing behind this because, you know, regardless of, you know, what country you're from, you know, America has some fairly good laws about some stuff and, you know, has a general idea of freedom, which, you know, is taken with, you know, it's not taken fully, unfortunately, but, you know, we try and do things, at least a lot of Americans that I know try and do things that, you know, aren't evil. But this is definitely, you know, in the evil category there. And I think that the restriction of information is, you know, the downfall of society is really what it is. You know, the more information that's out there, you know, the better people we can be, you know. And I think that I'm a better person for, you know, having the internet and having full access to everything on the internet, good, bad, and otherwise. And I think that I'm a better person for it. You know, I can do research into things like 9/11. You know, I can get the raw data, and I can make my own decisions. And I think that's how you make a smart, well-rounded society, instead of, you know, pulling this whole nanny state bullshit and saying, no, you can't look at this. No, you can't look at that. And I think, is it New Zealand that just instituted another great firewall? I know Australia has a pretty hardcore one. I think New Zealand was messing around with one there for a while, but I think they got tired of it for a bit. They might have just come in with a new one. I don't know. It's really bad to see, you know, Western countries restricting their citizenry like this. And, you know, it's just another thing that, you know, is wrong with the society today, you know. And I feel really sad to see this stuff.
Oh yeah, for sure. The thing is, this comes back to companies are going to try to make money. Now, some companies, especially big ones, as we've seen with Apple and Blue Coat, stuff like that, are going to be a lot more ruthless in how they make money than others. Now, they developed this technology. You can't stop technology from being developed. It's going to be developed, and there are uses for it. But they developed the censorship technology, basically speaking, which could be used in some situations for good, but there's a lot more profit to be made to get a whole country using it. So, because right now, even though they're trying really, really hard not to, the U.S. still pretty much stands up for some level of freedom of speech and rights and stuff like that. There's still some of that left. So the U.S. isn't going to implement this kind of stuff, so they're going to go to the countries that they know will implement this kind of stuff, which would be Syria and then, you know, Lebanon and Egypt and any of them that had horrible dictators. They're going to want to censor their people. So they're going to go to them first and foremost. Now, you can see the big difference between those countries and these countries. Most of the civilized countries, as it were, at one point or another, did value freedom of speech and the acquisition of knowledge and people being knowledgeable. And I mean, yeah, it's starting to change a little bit now, unfortunately. But, and the countries that don't have, or the countries that don't value freedom of speech and stuff like that are typically the mudhut savage countries around the world. So, this absolutely is the downfall of society, because if we restrict the free flow of information, we're basically restricting what made us better than the animals. Really, this is the only thing that we've got over some of the more intelligent animals, the fact that we write down, exchange information, and build up information over a long period of time. And since they're stopping that, I really hope this doesn't last more than our lifetimes, because if it does, then we're going to have some serious societal problems onto the next generations here.
And, you know, this is again, you know, something that kind of is an echo of 9/11, is something that's, you know, a ripple effect that's come down from 9/11, is the, you know, gradual lockdown of Western society and, you know, the devaluation of free speech and, you know, freedom to share information and share ideas, you know, be them extremist or, you know, non-extremist, whatever it is, you know. And that's kind of something that the United States is, you know, stood for, is that you can have these ideas, you know, be them crazy or not, as long as you're pretty much not hurting anybody, there shouldn't be too much of a problem. But, you know, and the Western world has emulated it somewhat, you know, especially with, you know, Britain and, you know, former British colonies and, you know, the Western world, essentially. And I've seen it, you know, just gradually get worse and worse and worse in the last decade. And it's really disturbing, because I've seen it, you know, they have the Great Firewall in Australia. Like I said, I think they have that one in England. And I know there's a couple, one or two in Europe, you know, in Western Europe. And, you know, then I see it happening here, as I see the gradual lockdown of information and what you can access and what you can't access. And, you know, I don't like that. That's not what, you know. Generally, I try and live my life by don't be evil. And I think that's, you know, pretty evil. That's, like you said, that's what separates us from the animals, is being able to communicate, being able to, you know, make systems, being able to talk to each other and to make things bigger than ourselves, you know? And by restricting us you know, breaking us down into these little groups that, you know, are completely isolated from each other. That doesn't help anybody. You know, yeah, the corporations may make a buck after, you know, for a little bit, but, you know, in the end, it's not going to help anyone. It's just going to make everybody worse off.
And that's why we do the show. Moving along, we're going to end the show on a little bit of a high note with some quantum computing news. Thanks to Psychros for this. Quantum processor hooks up with quantum memory. Now, of course, if you have been following quantum computing, this is actually kind of a huge development. Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, have become the first to combine a quantum processor with memory that can be used to store instructions and data. This achievement in quantum computing replicates a similar milestone in conventional computer design from the 1940s. Although quantum computing is now mostly a research subject, it holds out the promise for computers far more capable than those we use today. The power of quantum computers comes from the version of the most basic unit of computing, the bit. In a conventional computer, a bit can be represented either 1 or 0 at any time, basically on or off. Thanks to the quirks of quantum mechanics, the equivalent of a quantum computer, a qubit, can represent both values at once. When qubits in a superposition state work together, they can operate on exponentially more data at the same number of regular bits. As a result, quantum computers should be able to defeat encryption that is unbreakable in practice today and perform highly complex simulations. As well as breaking the encryption, it could make more encryption that's nearly impossible to break by conventional machines. The linking a processor and memory elements brings such applications closer, because it should be more practical to control and program a computer that can perform says Mario Mariantoni, who led this project and is part of a wider program at UCSB headed by John Martinez and Andrew Cleland. The design researchers adopted is known as the von Neumann architecture, named after John von Neumann, who pioneered ideas of making computers that combine processor and memory. Before the first von Neumann computer designs were built in the late 1940s, computers could be programmed only by physically reconfiguring them. Every single computer we use in our everyday life is based on the von Neumann architecture, and we have created a quantum mechanical equivalent, said Mariantoni. The only quantum computing system available to buy, priced at $10 million, lacks memory and works like a pre-von Neumann computer, so you need to manually input all the data yourself. Very, very cool.
Well, I kind of got to bust your balls here a little bit, my friend. You were really close, but it's Matteo Mariantoni, and that's von Neumann. It's a German name. You're close with the first one and way off on the second.
Curse you!
But you know, this is pretty cool. You know, every advance I see in technology, I think is great. You know, because you know, advancing in technology, really, we really have kind of stagnated. We've done a lot, but we've kind of stagnated a lot. You know, since the space program, you know, went downhill in the 1960s. I mean, just an old, you know, like clamshell style phone. You know, they used less computing power to get to the moon in the 1960s, which is, you know, quite impressive. And, you know, it shows that, yeah, we have advanced in a lot of technology, but we also haven't advanced in a lot of technology. So I see, you know, stuff like this, the more we can advance technology in all ways, you know, the better off we're going to be, and the quicker we can get to Mars, and the quicker we can start, you know, colonizing space, and we can spread our virus to other, you know, planets. So, I think that's always a good thing.
The thing I like to emphasize about quantum computers is that literally right where we're at with quantum computers right now is where we were at in 1940s, 1950s with contemporary computers, is that we have no idea, like we have some idea like with encryption and stuff like that, and maybe making artificial intelligence, but we really have no idea what this is going to mean for the next century, what quantum computers will be capable of, because they will be a hell of a lot more capable than modern computers because of that superposition state thing. It's not just a static one or zero, it's not on or off. And our brains work kind of a similar way. Our brains aren't just on or off, it's a more organic kind of processing.
Schrodinger's bit, it's neither on nor off.
Yeah.
But, You know, I don't, frankly, I don't see us, you know, advancing as much as we did in the last 7 years, in the next 7 years. I don't see us advancing as much as we have, like I said, in the last 7 years. Because if you compare, you know, 1940, whenever, you know, they were breaking the Enigma code and stuff, and the computers that they were using were just using, you know, like paper with holes punched in it. And, you know, they couldn't imagine, you know, something like, I hate to say it, especially with our last, you know, Apple story that we had where they were impersonating police officers and so on and so forth, but, you know, they couldn't imagine an iPad. You know, they would just, you know, completely, they'd lose it if they realized just how quickly, you know, technology had advanced, you know? And unfortunately, I don't see us advancing that far in the next 70 years, but, you know, I can always hope. You know, I'm fingers crossed here, I can always hope.
Well, I do see us advancing that far in the next 70 years. The only difference is I think we'll be a little bit better prepared for it, because in that time we've had a lot more speculative science fiction. So, and we've come up with some pretty good predictions of what we have, like the cell phone. Thank you. That didn't exist before.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, and
so we're going to handle it a lot again better.
Even with the iPad, you know, Star Trek. I mean, sorry. they kind of predicted that shit.
Yeah. So I mean, I do expect a leap on that scale. The only difference is it won't seem to be such a big deal as it was for us to leap on the scale to get to this point, because we've already started thinking ahead to what we could make, or some things are going to surprise us. Some things we just never would have comprehended right now to make. But I can't wait till we get a holodeck.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'll be all over that, you know. But, you know, the only way that we can figure this out is to, you know, wait 70 years, and we'll have to, you know, set our alarms for, you know, 70 years from now, and we'll have an archive of this show, and, you know, we'll just have to listen. And then we can come back, listen to the show, and see if we were right or wrong. But, you know, moving on to Recomedia here, we have the Chaos Computer Club 2011. Thanks again to the Doctor, who's been a power contributor for this last show. But recordings of the presentations and lectures from the Chaos Computer Camp 2011 are now online. They're free to download and redistributable from a number of locations. Some of the presentations are in English, others are in German, you know, not all of them are subtitled. But among the presentations this year were the Counseling Mischief is Thought Crime, latest developments around the Milky Mist system on chip, rocket propulsion basics, which is really cool, introduction to satellite communications, which is also interesting, open source photovoltaics, and black ops of TCP/IP 2011. So, you know, definitely check this out, and, you know, eat it all up, boys. You know, this is some good Recomedia here for you this week. And another thing that we have here is the Black Hat 2011 SSL and the Future of Authenticity, thanks to Psychros. And this talk provides an in-depth examination of the current problems with authenticity in SSL, discuss some of the recent high-profile SSL infrastructure attacks in detail, and cover some potential strategies in the future. It will conclude with software release that aims to definitively fix the disintegrating trust relationship at the core of the fundamental protocol. So, yet again, you know, something that's quite relevant, and I suggest you check that out. And thanks to Jewel Verboten, we have fun for the whole family. Giant slingshot cannon. That's all you need to know, you know? This isn't some, you know, crazy, you know, it doesn't have a political edge, it doesn't have a technology edge. This is just pure badass right here. But now for the Cyberpunk kit, we have the cheap hands-free underwater camera, you know? And, you know, you take anything underwater and its price increases exponentially. But this, you know, this is actually affordable, especially whenever you take into consideration all the rest of the diving equipment that you know, if you're scuba or anything like that, you know, if you're scuba certified, all the equipment's, you know, just ungodly expensive. This, you know, is, you know, HD, and the price is just going to blow you away. And it's called the Contour. And they've already produced a handful of imagers for football players and cyclists, but the company has now come out with a solution for underwater explorers as well, with the first waterproof camera, the Contour Roam. That is one word, Contour Roam. And this hands-free device boosts a super wide-angle, 170-degree rotating lens capable of capturing HD video in three different resolutions, 1080p, 960p, and 720p at 30 frames per second. The lens can also rotate up to 270 degrees and projects a horizontal laser to help you align your shots. This is pretty cool. The camera's instant on-record option, meanwhile, allows you to start recording as soon as you turn it on. No wait. Boom, on, it's recording. And while its waterproof aluminum body lets you shoot video at underwater depths of up to 1 meter for up to 30 minutes at a time, meaning you can leave that old Contour HD case at home, aspiring Steve Zissous can buy one now for $200. Now, unfortunately, I didn't see the whole 1 meter thing. But, you know, 1 meter's better than no meters, so, you know, this is yet another step in the right direction for cheap, affordable underwater tech. And, you know, if it can survive underwater, then you sure as hell know that it'll stand up to a lot of stuff here up on land. And, the daily hack for you today is take a crack at reverse engineering the Cray disk format, thanks again to the Doctor! And, this is the source code for the OS of the original Cray 1 supercomputer, that is thought to have been lost. Now, if you remember, the Cray supercomputers were also featured quite prominently in Jurassic Park the novel, just as a little aside there, you know, but a CDC-9877 disk pack was located that may contain some of the software and possibly the source code. No functional drive has been found for the disk pack, but a robot was specifically constructed to extract the contents of the disk on a sector-by-sector basis. The disk image was made available to whomever wanted to take a crack at extracting the data, and all of that is up on archive.org. There are two links for that, and like I said, they're both up for archive.org.
Don't worry, we will be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We'd like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out the album Land of Fans and Music by various artists. We fade out with a track from that album called Downtime. Best of all, this album is free, and I'll drop a link in the show notes. Remember, everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if we react to his throats, so until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.